Hello, everyone, and welcome to episode 23 of Sean Hammer. As you'll notice by the title of the show, today is called Before Sean Hammer. And what that means is before I started doing Sean Hammer, I used to be on another podcast called the Miscast Podcast with a friend of mine, Jason Justice. Unfortunately, his podcast didn't go very long. I don't know exactly the reason why. We never spoke of it, but I don't know if it was... He gave a big old reason, and, you know, he didn't like the bad emails and stuff. And you know what? I ignore the bad emails. I take it in. I try and change stuff, but I don't really dwell over it. I love the good emails. I love the good iTunes reviews. And I love my good fans. So, podcasting. Why Warhammer Podcast, Sean? Well, first and foremost, we'll get to that in a minute, actually. I do have a week in Warhammer for you all. I actually played some games with my new Wood Elf army, the 1,250-point army list. Not too bad. I played two games against Ogre Kingdoms. My list consisted of 3 units of Dryads, 8 in each unit, a 5-man unit of Wild Riders, completely tooled up with full command and everything, no magic banner. I took 3 Treekin, 1 Tree Man, 1 Branch Wraith, no magic, which she was a magic user, yes. 1 Wood Elf Noble on with the, you know, the whole Wood Elf, I mean, Forest Spirit Kindred thing, and on a Great Stag. I also took Annoyance and Nedlings and Murderous Spite or something like that. Oh, I'll get it better, and I'm just doing this off the fly. But anyway, I went up on both days against, I had their, the Ogres had their main, hero guy, don't know what he's called, he had a brace of handguns, he was tooled up with a 5 plus war save. He also had 5 lead belchers, 4 bulls, or whatever they're called, with great weapons, 2 units with just regular weapons. I think there were 5 apiece as well. And he took 3 Rhinox Riders. What a pain in the ass those models are. And you'll see that later on in this episode, actually. I am going to replay an old Dogs of War review that I did. And I didn't cover the Rhinox Riders. I wasn't really aware of them when I did the Dogs of War Army. But, Army review. But let me tell you, they might make their way into my Dogs of War army list. Well, anyway, we played on Friday, our first game. And the setup was pretty standard. There was a total of 2 woods, a small little... that was about it. 2 woods. And then I got my free one for the Wood Elves. And I let him go. He rolled the die to go first. And, anyway, he took his turn, and I took mine, and I thought I'd be all ballsy with these Wild Riders. And I figured everyone tells me all the choice in the Wood Elf books, you know, the gold. Anyway, I run up, bam, second turn, his turn, he shoots 5 lead belchers into them. Absolutely no misfires. Rolling 10s and 8s on the artillery dice. And he hit, somehow, he's hit with his Ballistic Skill 3 with everything. Couldn't make a ward save, and my Wild Riders just disintegrated. Next up, I charged with 2 units of, well, I moved up. I did a little tree singing with my tree man. I actually did the tree surfing thing. I don't find it very useful to my liking. I know other people make it work quite successful, but to my liking, in that game, it didn't work all too well. I moved the forest up, and I had a unit of Dryads and a Tree Man in the forest. Didn't really do nothing yet. His turn, he moved up. He stayed stationary with lead belchers, positioned other stuff around. I was up. I charged with 2 units of Dryads into lead belchers. He did attach his hero into a unit of lead belchers. I charged with my hero unchallenged. Which is basically the one-trick pony for him, is he's got the Annoyance of Nettlings, so in a challenge you need 6s to hit him. and I get the murderous bites. They add a D6 strength 2 magical attacks that count as poison and such and such. I went in. He blew away one unit of dryads. He beat the other one. They ran. And caused a panic. Well, they caused a panic test. My general stayed, so they stayed in the challenge and everything. And I eventually beat him. Then for the rest of the game, the tree man won. That's the only thing that really did anything to my army. My tree king got killed by the bulls with the great weapons. I had a unit of dryads that basically did nothing. But my tree men took out the Rhinox riders pretty decently. Pretty fair exchange of points out of the two. And ended up coming up to a draw at the end of the game. Now, Saturday when we played, a lot of people at the hobby store say the reason, you know, they're like, oh, did you play Sean Hammer? Because I usually win, like, quite good with the armies that I pick. But this army, I wanted something colorful and a lot of flavor and stuff like that. High in fiber, too. Anyway, I set up. The terrain consisted of one forest on my side for my free forest, a small little ruin with hedges, and a hill. Hill was in the middle. Basically, all the terrain was pretty much centered in the middle of the board, pretty much. Well, anyway, for the first three turns, I did nothing but maneuver my armies around. And, you know, like I said, people used to call it Sean Hammer because there's a joke. This one guy said, oh, you must be cheating. You know, no one can win this bad. So they, instead of Warhammer, it's called Sean Hammer. Well, this game was called, excuse me, females in my audience, but Vagina Hammer. That's what it was labeled. I spent the first three turns avoiding everything he had. I used tree singing to move the woods up to close the gap between the hill and the little ruins, which were on the edge of the board. The hills had a rocky outcrop on the side, so he couldn't go past the rocky outcrop. It was difficult terrain or impassable. I forgot what we agreed on. So I basically used the woods to plug that up. I baited him with my tree man to come forward with his Rhinox riders. I used my wild riders cavalry movement and moving through forests, fast cavalry movement, to get on the backside of his regular bulls. I basically eventually ended up decimating them. Used my tree kin to take out. I forgot what I did. I just charged regular ogres with them. And they did well, and they ended up breaking those. A couple of the bulls broke. And I flanked him while his Rhinox riders were in the woods. On both sides were some dryads in the front with the tree man. My general, well, my hero, didn't do quite well this game. He ended up dying, and a stag ran, And that was it for that. I made my leadership test and everything. At the end of the game, it ended up coming down to only thing he had left was two Rhinox riders. Well, with basically one and a half by the time you take up the wounds. And he was running off the table with them. I was quite proud of myself. And I know it's not really a true Wood Elf list because it's just forest spirits, but I like the way they look. My demon trees performed very well this weekend. I'm not dissatisfied with them, and I look forward to playing with them again, and maybe even making the army a little bit larger in the future. Well, anyway, that's it for my week in Warhammer. Oh, nope, I just received the new Blood Angels Codex. The next podcast will be an army overview of the Blood Angels. It'll probably be a little bit longer podcast, just like today, but it'll be nothing but Blood Angels. And it's a nice book. I bought the Sanguinary Guard, so I can paint them using the White Dwarf's non-metallic metallics. And but the rest of the book seems okay. I don't know if I'm going to go with it. I'm probably still going to stay with my Space Wolves. My devotion to each army right now is basically one unit of Space Wolf box of 10 and 1 unit of sanguinary guard. 5 models, unput together, just like the Space Wolves, in another box. So we'll see what that develops to in the near future. I play iGuard, and we'll go over that in a while. I mean, in the future show. But let's go ahead and go with the beginning intro. I used to do a podcast with a friend of mine, Jason Justice. Like I said, he quit for whatever reasons he felt necessary, and that would work. And I did a few shows I really quite enjoyed with him. Now, when it first started out, I used to listen to a survival podcast hosted by a gentleman named Jack Spirico. And it's basically modern survival, you know, talk about food storage and different things, being prepared, you know. I mean, not even for a disaster, but just for, you know, if you lose your job or something. So it's pretty entertaining to listen to. Don't agree with them all the time, but I do like the show a lot. But I haven't listened to any gaming podcasts. And buddy of mine, Jason, comes up and says, "Hey, Sean, you know, you like to talk about Warhammer, and half the time I can't just shut up. How would you like to do a podcast with me? At least a guest host on my show." I was like, "Fine, I'll go ahead and do this." So it took him about 2 to 3 weeks to get me there because I really kind of thought this idea was kind of silly. And finally did it in the first episode. I was like, okay. I believe the first episode we did, I went over the vampire counts as well. Then he said, "Oh, you know, that was pretty good." And he got a fair amount of positive feedback on it. So he says, "Why don't you show up to second show?" So we went ahead to the second show, and my growth for doing the podcast, for each show we did, got greater and greater. Now, the pinnacle of this that decided I really like doing this is I met Dan Abnett. And Jason and I did an interview at Games Day Toronto with him. And, wow, I really think he is my favorite author out there. I've read everything that he's done. His Gaunt's Ghost books are great. His Ravener, his Eisenhorn books are fantastic. Every fantasy book he's done, I've been totally happy with, especially Malice Darkblade. So, as far as everything goes, this man has really kept me reading and kept me busy in novels from the Black Library for quite some time here. So we had a great interview with him. It's out in the hallway. You'll hear, I'm going to play that interview today. And you hear quite a bit of noise in the background because we were at a games day. And that was, like I said, that was the pinnacle of my excitement for doing the podcast. It slowly weaned away after that with Jason. I don't really know why, but a lot of it went around some email that some people didn't like me, and I was just like, "Who cares, man? People don't like me, they don't have to listen." Or it gives them somebody they can, like, hate. It's kind of like wrestling, you know? You got one guy that's a jerk, one guy that's your hero. And so I think that affected him quite a lot. Then it started slowing down, and he had another host on there after I thought I was actually official co-host of the show. So that weaned off, and I thought we got back into it, and you'll listen to the beginning of the show where I thought we were going to on my show where I thought we were going to start doing them back and forth, my show and his. It never happened. He just fell off, and he's not doing it anymore. And I was just like, "God, I really enjoyed talking about Warhammer. I like interacting with people who have like interests. I enjoy making people feel good. I love arguing with people sometimes. I love boasting people's confidence other times. I like brightening up people's days with little tidbits of extra crap I've acquired over the years." I was just like, "I'm going with it." And my wife was very supportive in this, and she's just like, she thought from the get-go that I should have done my own podcast. And well, here we are today, and we're at episode 23 of Sean Hammer. So like I said, today we're going to I got an interview with Dan Abnett, myself, and Jason Justice. And I also have Dogs of War Army Review that I've done with Jason in the past. I think it was last year before Adepticon. So this will give you, for all of you who haven't checked out the links on the side of the show or the site, I'll give you a chance to go ahead and hear two of what I think are my favorite sections I've done on the Miscast podcast. I mean, I like the banter between me and Jason, and I know I've have some I've gotten some email from some listeners that said, you know, I need to have a show host so I can stop doing a single podcast and it's a little bit more entertaining. So I do understand it and I'm working on it. The technical aspect of the podcast is a little different for me and it's new. So I'm slowly getting there, and there will eventually be guest hosts on it quite regularly after that. So just be patient with me and enjoy yourself. And we'll go ahead right now with a... I think we'll start with the Dogs of War Army review. So, enjoy. Oh, there's a fair amount of people playing them in the tournament scene. And people like seeing them in there, and they always get mentioned. I mean, even when...
But so were Chaos Dwarves.
Yeah, but they're getting... Did you hear what's going on with Chaos Dwarves now?
I heard they're not getting a book, but people that are trying to come up with an actual...
I hear they're getting a
living
book.
Rule book.
They're getting a rule book, but it's a Forge World. Specific army, just like the Death Troopers of Krieg. So it's going to be all...
That's awesome. Your Chaos Dwarves will cost like $800.
Yep, and the book will cost you $45. Yay.
Well, you can't say... They're not making anything for fantasy.
Yep, they shot that right out of the water.
Literally. So, looking at the army, Sean.
That was a long pause. I didn't know what to do with it. I was looking at my list.
let's start into the characters. What can you take with the Dogs of War army?
Special characters?
Let's start with a basic, just the Dogs of War. Then we'll work in the regiments we're now.
There is virtually... Basically, only three characters you can pick. Oh, I know there. I mean, I know I can look at it. You got the hireling lord, the mercenary captain. You got the wizard, hireling wizard, and you got the smaller wizard. And there's the always ever have to be there paymaster, which I think he's pretty cool. He's another nice little niche to the army that makes it fun to play. He's just pretty cool. I was like, they're not bad. As for stats in every way, and their points aren't too shabby. One thing I would like to throw out there, because it'll be quick, and with the characters, there's not a lot of magic you can take with this army. Magic items?
You're just the common items.
Yep. If you're playing friendly games, Army Builder has a list of special items that are compiled from, I don't know, Warhammer journals and such like that you can choose. But as for anything else, it's just... The bare bones, you got to go on them, you know, just the skill of the model. So when you do win, you can rub it in saying you didn't need all those fancy dancy magic items.
To run the army competitively, it's kind of hard because you don't have the magic items. You have cool units. But like when you're using a level 2
wizard
I feel I just run a level 1 scroll caddy. You can roll a level 2, maybe try to chuck a fireball or something, but the cost points per what you get out of it, I don't like it.
Yeah. It's rough. It really is. I don't even rely on a wizard when I take Dogs War Army. Like you said, he's just a scroll caddy, stopping those really bad spells. Conflagration of Doom is one you really want to stop. And... anything that'll do.
Fire's your friend. What are you talking about?
Whatever. I think the Forest Spirits will agree that it is not. There's a rule that you have to remember with your paymaster. It's pretty cool. He's in charge of everything more than the general because he's got the cash. He's treated exactly like a battle standard bearer. So you get the +1 combat resolution and reroll break test within 12 inches. He can be captured by the enemy if he's killed, etc. But if he is killed, every unit in the army must take a panic test at the end of that phase. And from that point on, every unit in the army will hate the enemy unit that captured the paymaster's key. So I've had that kind of work out, you know. I think it was against...
In your favor?
Yeah, where the Nurgle unit, that was virtually basically impossible for me to kill with that guy with the regeneration banner and stuff. They killed my paymaster. I let it happen just so I could get the hatred rule. And I did pull out a minor victory in that battle. So it was pretty cool. Now, the Dogs of War are broken up into two different types of lists.
Into core.
Well, they have core. Yeah.
And in your core units, you know, you have your pikemen, your ogres, your cavalry, your light cavalry, your dwarves, halfling hop-hop, which is like my most favorite war machine in the game. I don't know why. You have cannons, and, you know, so that's your basic bare-bones units. We can go over those in a second. And you have the regiments of renown, which are kind of like special characters, but not special characters. And there's a couple of special rules that go with each one. And they're pretty unique way to play, too, because your unit champions are beefier than regular unit champions. And makes for a fun time in your favor.
And they actually have hero stats. Yeah, they're literally heroes.
So we'll go through and we'll hit pikemen first. Obviously, the best choice.
Love them.
Yes. They always strike first, unless you're playing against high elves.
Woo-hoo.
Because for some odd reason, hundreds of years of training outweigh the fact that your weapon's 20 feet
long.
Yeah. And, it's just this high elves just look at them and say, oh, I'm still go first. Anyway, they're pretty cool. You fight in three ranks if you charge. You can fight in four if you stand stationary. And if you're charged by a cavalry or monster size base, you get a +1 to your strength. And it's just phenomenal. You do lose that bonus, though, if you are charged from the side. But you don't lose it against the front unit. You don't get it against the side or the flank.
You'd be amazed at how people forget about that. Yes. And they charge in there with...
And they get mad.
You get mad at you, and you're like, I just brought the army.
Oh, my favorite was charged by unit of Chaos Knights. And he, you know, anyone who runs Chaos Knights get that gleam because, you know, they're all Khorne Knights and stuff like that. And when they run into your frontage, they think they're, you know, Superman. And, well, when you're rolling, I think what it was 23 strength. I think it ended up being 4 attacks. You know, and it was just phenomenal. And you're gonna roll a couple little numbers
for armor saves.
In my favor, I loved it. It was just like it immediately followed my laughter. Well, that's it for the pikemen. You got crossbowmen for a simple 8 points per model.
Great.
Nothing special to say there. They got the same rules as regular crossbowmen all throughout.
Was it skill 3?
Yep. Now, my favorite unit for the core choice for the regular bare bones Dogs of War unit is the duelists. All I gotta say, they're awesome. They skirmish, weapon skill 4, ballistic skill 3. They can have a sword. They may have bucklers.
What are bucklers?
Just small shields, counter shields. They can have throwing knives on top of that, and they may have pistols. And
so they're armed to the teeth.
Yeah, they can have 2 pistols. And I don't know about anybody out there, but you can pretty much make short work of heavy armored units against them because the pistols are strength 4 with an additional -1 on your armor save. And I just like skirmish units, and they're pretty cool. Mine look like little savvy Spanish guys, and I like them. You got your heavy cavalry, which are just, you know, they're 19 points, just regular weapon skill 4, strength 3. I don't usually take these too much because I have a better choice in the regiments in the renown section. You have your light cavalry, which, in my opinion, you can't beat them. I mean, they got the same stats, same stats as the horse they ride on. They're 11 points, and they have fast cavalry. I mean, I got a unit of desert guys. I made it look like, Muslims or whatever, and it's just...
Oh, I thought those were the actual El Mukhtar's desert dogs that you had.
I don't know. I don't know what they were.
He's got these models like
on Different Games Workshop. I remember that.
Sure. We'll use them.
You can have... that's it for the core. You have ogres for your special units. 35 models apiece. You get a little bit of little stopping power in your army.
If you use the normal ogres, you don't get the bull charge.
No bull charge. Yeah, and I was going to hit that because I did read the FAQ, and it's like a lot of things made sense that I didn't even think to ask, and I thought were kind of, why would you ask that? But I guess in the long run, I was like, oh, that's why you would. But I think one of the best units for special would be your dwarves. For 7 points per model, I think you end up taking them up to 14 by the time you do everything. But they got hand weapon, light armor, great weapons, crossbows, heavy armor, and shields. Plus, they follow every little rule that the new Dwarf Army book follows. So they got hatred for green skins. I mean, they pursue, you know, the same, and they still get the march move no matter what. And for 7 points apiece, a shooting unit, whew, pretty good, pretty good. Unit I don't take is Norris Marauders. I don't know why I don't. I just don't think I have the models. So, Frenzy unit running around. And you can have the Paymaster Bodyguard, which are okay. Toughness 3, Weapon Skill 4. They're stubborn if the Paymaster's with them.
I'll be honest. Birds. I had my partner play him a big block of them at Adepticon.
Didn't work.
It was great for him. Nothing touched him, really. I mean, because I took the brunt of stuff. But I just felt it was a big point sink. I mean, if you could try to compare a Paymaster and his bodyguard to a Slaan and a Temple Guard, there's no comparison.
They're only worth it to take if you take if you're playing with special characters and play Midas Mean. But other than that, there's no reason to take them. Halflings, 6 points per model, hand weapon and bow. They can swap their bows for spears and light armor if you want, and shields. I don't know why you would want to, but if you got the model, I can imagine it.
Just to be like, ah. Yeah.
They suffer no movement penalties when moving through woods, and they have ballistic skill 4. That's not bad for just 6 points a model.
Just to let you guys know, if you ever have at a local GW workshop or something like that where they go, we're doing a skink shootout where you try to kill as many skinks as you can with 50 points, you take halfling archers. I'll tell you what, you can fit like 5 of them in there. Oh, no.
No, it was like 9.
It was 9.
It was. No, 8. You took 8.
Yeah, I took 8 of them. And they actually had to gang up on me. The actual...
The coordinators ganged up on me.
They let little kids play with, like, wood elves. And I'm like, what? Come on. This must be a fair game. I can't help it. I read the rules.
You said, Sean, you got halflings, right? And I was like, yes, I do. Rare units, you got a cannon. You use a small... the rules for the small cannon on page 122 of the main rule book. And you have the halfling hop-hop. It's beautiful. It's a nice-looking model.
I can't believe it weighs their stew.
Yeah, but it treats as a stone thrower from the rulebook. And the hop high has a maximum range of 36 inches. Results are strength 3, but there's no armor saves allowed against it. And underneath the template, it's strength 6. And it's flat 50 points. I mean, it's nice. I think it's a nice addition to any army, especially if you do happen to have some halflings roaming around besides them.
And you're going up against ranked infantry.
Yeah.
It never hurts.
Well, that's it for out of the regiments of renown. I mean, sorry, Dogs of War. There's other units you can take that count as regular Dogs of War that aren't in this book. And those will be the regular Giants. I forgot what White Dwarf they're in. Lead Belchers from the Ogre Kingdom book. And Bulls, you can take those. And I think once the Man-Eaters, you can run those as well. I mean, so that allows you to take a little bit more of the Ogre Kingdom books. You know, you can take some of the units and expand your range of models if you wish. Now, for the regiments for the renown, there's a few. There's a couple pikemen units in there that I generally always take the one. I don't know why. I just think I like the character. We'll get to them. The first one's Pizarro's Lost Legion.
What's your viewpoint, Sean?
My viewpoint, I don't like them. I don't like that mixed unit and giving up your pikes in the front for crossbows. And I was just like, I just don't see the reason to have them.
I love them. I think the ability, when you don't have a lot of shooting in your Dogs of War army to begin with, to be able to have that ability, because no matter what, even if they still, if they charge you, you're going to get a stand and shoot, only unless they're too close. So you're going to still do your shots, technically strength 4. Then you're going to get your pikes. And then but if they're calved, then you're still getting it. I don't feel you're really losing attacks. You still got the same ballistic skill and same weapon skill. So I don't see why you wouldn't want to mix it up a little bit.
The reason I don't, too, is I'm not big. I don't take Dogs of War regular crossbowmen, for one. Because I don't like the whole move or shoot. I'll get to the ones I do use on a quite regular basis in a moment. So when you you put your front ranks as crossbow, and you do have to maneuver that unit, you lose the shooting attack, and I just think just buy crossbowmen. So I don't know. That and they look like Spanish conquistadors, and they're a pain in the butt.
And I love their hat. they're hard to paint. Their helmets are sweet.
The next is Rico's Republican Guard. I would like to mention that all the regiments of renown, for the basic cost, you usually get like 10 guys or 5 if they're cavalry unit. Quite expensive for what they are, but it does give you a little bit of character in your army. And it's hard to make a complete regiment of renown army because you do have not a lot of troops. So if you're trying to, paint up an army quick, that's the way to go. But the next is Rico's Republican Guard. Basic stats is basically every pikeman unit out there, except they have strength 4, so and heavy armor, and they come with it. So
they're the elite pikemen.
Yeah, so it's nice when strength 5 on a charge from cavalry. That's like.
Do you feel that they're the best looking pike unit in the game?
No. No.
I do.
Really? I really like the Okani Fellowship.
Really?
Yes, I really
do. I thought you'd like the Lipo's Leopards.
Oh, they're really cool looking, too, but I don't usually play them a lot to actually see them all the time. I always take the Okani Fellowship. They're cheaper. They're cheaper than the points of the basic Dogs of War pikemen.
I said best looking.
Best looking. I know. I like them, too. They got kind of like the Spartan helmets. And I think of all my Dogs of War army, I happen to paint those ones the best. Yeah. So, because they look the best to me, because my paint job and everything, I just like them. I don't know why. They're crappy stats.
That's a great argument. I just do.
Yeah, I just do.
Shut up, Jason.
No, the Leopold's Leopards really look good. The Rico's Republican Guard, they look good. I mean, it's just all your taste. It seems like they're taking it from different eras of history. And here's, pikeman unit from here, pikeman unit from there. I think it's the Spartan helmets that really do it for me, more than anything. County Fellowship, their leader, I like him. His name's Rodrigo. He's got 3 attacks, strength 4, weapon skill 4. It's pretty cool. The unit sucks. They do have a weapon skill too, but you're paying less for them.
But they're cheaper. I mean,
yeah, they're cheaper.
And you get a hero, and you get an extra hero.
Yeah. The Leopold's Leopards is the last one. They're the most expensive unit.
But rightfully so. They're immune to psych.
They're immune to psychology, and they have light armor. So I guess. Functional purposes, Rico's Republican Guard's the best. But Leopold's Leopards, Leopold has pistol, heavy armor as well.
Stand and shoot
what? With it. And no one ever expects that of a pikeman unit unless, you see the front rank armed with crossbows. and they're cool. They're cool looking models. Next unit we have is actually a duelist unit. I don't see the reason for taking these, just because they're too expensive for what they are. You can tool up a regular unit of duelists to be more effective, but these are Vesperals, Vendettas. The guy's pretty cool. He's got a skull mask, and they look like a whole bunch of, duelists. I know that's with the capes and everything.
You can make that guy look like the V from Vendetta.
Yeah, V from Vendetta. He causes fear. They got cloak and dagger, which gives them a 6+ armor save. But as we all know, 6+ means nothing anymore in Warhammer because everything's got 4 or higher. So, and of course, they're skirmish. The unit of crossbowmen that they got here are pretty good. Marksman and Marengo. Solid ballistic skill at 4 with crossbows and light armor. Not too bad for a crossbow unit, and they virtually end up being 11 points apiece. And that's not a bad point cost for them. Next we have El Mactar's Desert Dogs. For fast cav units, I feel it's too much points. I want 245 points for the unit. They got a weapon, hand weapon, shield, and war horse. That was just like, I don't know. There's a couple units that just don't seem feasible to take, but if you got them, you might as well. My favorite crossbow unit in the game is Bragnaza's Besiegers. I think those are the finest looking models.
You just like the Pavés.
I think the armor. I think they are the finest looking
they do look good.
Unit in the Dogs of War army.
It's funny that they're the best looking unit, even though technically the pavase covers up like 3/4 of the model.
Yeah, and it kind of took me off because I painted them up really nice and put the pavase in front. But I know it's there. I know it's there. But I always use them in my Dogs of War army. They got, you know, they have a ballistic skill 3. You know, oh well. But they do have a 3+ armor save, which is pretty nice. They got the crossbow. The leader, he's pretty stacked himself. He's got ballistic skill 5, weapon skill 5. He's got 3 attacks on his own, and he's got pistols, crossbows. And it's just like he's pretty solid. It's nice nice centerpiece for an army, especially if you're going to run crossbow men anyway. The cavalry unit. This is, I believe, one of the finest cavalry units in the game. I guess for humans.
I'm gonna get like 8 emails.
Yeah, human.
Do it again, Sean.
Human cavalry, not chaos or anything, but these and a lot better than what you have in a Dogs of War choice is Volans Venedators. Not bad. 195 points, strength 4, knights running around. Volan himself has 3 attacks. And it's just they are unbarded war horse. You know, to get the 2+ armor save. I like them. They may not be at best in the game, but they're my favorite for human cavalry. Now we have Borg, Bearstruck, and the Beastman of Urzolo. Yep, we're back right on the fact that I don't use Norse Marauders, so I don't have these guys.
What do you
think
stats-wise?
They're okay. There's like 3/3/3s. It's just like 2 attacks. You know, the Bearmen only have 1. They have Frenzy. The one guy can turn into a bear. That's pretty cool. I mean, not he is kind of like a bear to look like, but I kind of bought that unit, and he's in my vampire count army now because it's a werewolf. Come on.
Werewolf in London.
Yeah. Well, after that, you know, I could go through and give all the points and stuff, but basically everything's in a regiment, so no one is looking at 4/3 weapon skill, 4/3 ballistic skill. Everything's toughness 3. Armor saves are generally either light or heavy armor. Shields don't exist too much in the footmen because it takes 2 hands to use pikes and stuff. So, I mean, that's with stats. We have Ogla Khan's Wolf Boys. They look cool if you want to run Wolf Riders. It's a nice little addition to your army. Not too much for special rules or anything, but if you want to run Wolf Boys. Next unit is another blessed unit of halflings. It's the Lumping Croups Fighting Cocks. I feel like I'm 12 reading that word. Pretty.
What, Lumpkin?
Yeah, Lumpkin. They're not bad. You start off a unit size of, I think it is 5. That includes 3 different special characters for 90 points. The unit has a ballistic skill 4. The heroes have a ballistic skill 5. They come with a hand weapon and bow. And they're not bad. They're skirmishers. I mean, so a nice looking unit to have out there, especially if you want to run bows instead of crossbows so you can move and fire without taking, you know, too much penalty. Next unit is Gulfag's Ogres. Just run a unit of regular ogres. Don't even worry about this. And if you got them, play them. But for the points, yeah, I wouldn't really worry about it because the base ogre for the unit is 45 points, and they're same exact stats as a regular ogre for 35. Next is one of the better units in the game, I think. Well, Dogs of War Army, not game. Let me correct that. I think they're awesome. It's Longjong Slayer Pirates. We're talking about, you have slayers, of course. They do have 2 attacks apiece. They're festooned with pistols. And according to the FAQ, they still get the original festooned rule so they can use their strength for armor piercing two attacks every turn. So, I mean, that's pretty decent. Longjong is pretty dang sweet, especially if you want to put them out as a challenge to hold up a enemy character advance because resolute or whatever.
I think they're a great anvil.
They very are. They're unbreakable. The festoon with pistols is just freaking awesome. And it was just like they're slayers, and you know,
all the rules, good about having him die though, because like
yeah, all
good
the
death.
Yep, good death. All the rules for slayers apply, and not only that, it's just if someone's silly enough to charge you with a large target, and you got a block of 20, it's 40, ballistic skill 3 and 4, multiple shot. handgun shots at that target, because every unit gets to fire at a large target, every rank gets to fire a large target, then, you know, takes away the point of being a slayer, I guess.
Do you find that when you play them, that they're supposed to die, but they always seem to last really
long?
They're
the last unit left
to
die.
For myself, when I play with them a lot, it just seems like you can't die.
I put them out there to die, and it's just like, it backfires. The next is kind of weird. It's a unit, but it's also kind of a character. It's Azanar, thank you, God, the Dragon Lord. He rides a dragon, and, you know, he's got a magic weapon that doesn't make him count as a large target, so that's pretty cool. And he does get all those basic rules that High Elves get, so before the High Elf book came out, I guess he wasn't really that good, but when the High Elf book did come out, his 4... Strength 6 attacks are going to be always strike first, you know, and, well, strength 4 if he doesn't charge, so that's pretty decent. So I guess you can't really complain too much. If you want a dragon, you got one. You got the Galloper guns. They're cool. There's a lot of flavor to them if you want to move around your cannons and everything, but
I see a lot of people run them.
Yeah, they're cool. I do have a couple myself, but I don't really use them as the Galloper guns. I just use them as the cannons. You have one unit that they totally screwed, and that would be the Birdman of Katraza.
Beautiful models.
Beautiful models. Like, totally sweet. They used to have crossbows, be able to move and shoot. They had armor save back in the day. Well, no more armor save. No more crossbows. Even though the model has crossbows, they count as short bows. And, oh, it's just like, they're just,
and if they get
expensive.
Too close to the sun, they fall to the ground.
Yeah, they're like 25 points for an archer. That is going to get decimated just because you can fly closer to something. They used to be decent. I was just like, ugh, why? Next one's Giants of Albion. Pretty cool, I guess. Before the new Giants came out. That's all I gotta say. The new Giants are a little bit cheaper. Sure, you don't get Hengist, the a free wizard with them. But the two Giants are Leadership 6. They're not stubborn like the new Giants, and they had a lot of character to go with, but when they made Giants available to almost three-quarters of the Warhammer world...
I was going to get Giants.
Good. You always strike first, douche. So they're not really that good to take anymore. You got Tichy Hoochie's Raiders, another unit that's just there for looks. Their abilities aren't that great. You know, regular cold ones cause fear. They have stupidity. They're blessed by the old ones. It's just, as for their point value, they're a little bit too expensive to take. I could be wrong. And another unit next. I mean, and none of these, I mean, there is like no rare or core on any of these. It depends what army you play them in. Let me give you an example. For hire, we'll go back to Volan's Venedators. Let's see. Volan's Venedators can be hired as a core unit in Dogs of War armies. So they're core in Dogs of War. Alternately, they can be hired as a rare unit in other Warhammer armies. So they come as rare in other Warhammers, except Britonia, which just can't hire him at all.
Tranking anything.
Yeah, so it's just like...
too proud.
So if you're wondering why I'm not going through core and everything, each and every unit counts as something different. You got Rugled's Armored Orcs. They're okay. Not bad. A big unit of orcs.
Seen some greenskin armies.
Yeah, toughness 4. They have crossbows, choppas. They ignore greenskin panic. There's a special goblin in there called Maggot who gives you a +2 to combat resolution. In addition, Maggot seems to delete a char life and as a result has a 3+ ward save and he cannot accept challenges. I was just like pretty lucky goblin, I guess. They got their own little animosity chart. If you fail it 1 through 2, this is let's show them what crossbows can do. Yeah, they kind of just shoot at the closest unit, friend or foe. Kind of bad, I guess. A little bit worse than the Animosity.
But that's very old school Greenskins, which I actually really miss.
Yeah, and 3-6 is Squabble. The last unit in the book itself is the Curse Company. It has the most special rules to any Dog's War unit. Base size is 305 points. Very good unit. A little bit too expensive for what they are, but they are undead. Led by an undead character who actually has magic items. So it's one of the rare few magic items that's exclusive for Dogs of War. He's got a sword, gives a plus one of strength. All close combat maids by Victor, the leader, have killing blow. Victor has a 4+ ward save and the banner of malediction, which when you lose combat, instead of taking 3 models, you lose only 2. They have a special rule called Join Us in Damnation. Any model that wounds another model, that's any Curse Company that wounds another model and kills them, they join the unit of undead. So your unit can get bigger by killing more. Victor has hatred of all other undead, so he's a little bit handy for against maybe Vampire Counts or Tomb Kings. And actually in that account, Victor also counts as, let's say, a Vampire Count or whatever. So if you do destroy him, the unit starts to crumble as per the crumble rules. Of course, they're immune to psychology. They take break tests just like undead, charge reactions just like undead. They may march as long as Victor's still alive. And, of course, the Curse Company causes fear. I really think I like this unit because I do play undead, and this gives me Lizardmen and Skaven undead models, as well as a high elf standard bearer for the unit and a couple dwarf undead. So that's pretty cool. There's a few other units that are throughout White Dwarfs. I don't have those handy with me, but it's just like the Manslayers, a cool skirmish dark elf unit that basically virtually impossible to shoot at. But as for everything, the army's got great character. Doesn't have too bad stats. And I really wish Games Workshop would do something with them.
I would love to see a new army book, but I really don't think we're going to see one anytime in the future.
And closest thing we saw was when they redid the Dogs of War inside that White Dwarf, and they gave you some conversion projects to make pikemen.
Yeah.
And that was about it.
Let's see. So, Sean?
Well, I got the special characters if anyone wants to go through. I'm not going to do special characters because no one lets you play with them anyway, and it just makes me mad because I like them.
Yeah. Well, if you were creating a list, what is the 3 fundamental things that need to be in a Dogs of War list?
I believe 2-3 units of solid block pikemen. Never less than 2. I always think 2-3.
Side by side?
Side by side, it doesn't matter, but in your army list, there has to be at least 2. Also on the army list, well, you know, of course you always got to take a paymaster. Take advantage of the diversity that you have. You got a good unit of crossbowmen and also the dwarfs for what you can stack the dwarfs with. They make a great versatile unit. So I would probably say not bad for a second choice. And third, the best thing out of the army, I'll give it to anything, is pick something that will bring you pleasure to play. A little fun aspect to the unit. I mean, you know, to the army that you have that fits your theme, fits your strategy for the game. And I believe that Dogs of War have quite a few choices to handle a lot of different situations if you know who you're playing. So, like, if I know I'm going against undead, Slayer Pirates, really good. Even over top of the Curse Company because they are unbreakable. You know, but at least the two fundamentals is nice shooting and definitely don't skimp out on the pikemen because...
Would you classify duelists as shooting?
Yes. Yeah, duelists I would. I know they're a hand-to-hand unit and stuff, but I don't ever really get a hand-to-hand unless my pikemen are threatened by something that I know they can't handle. Then my duelists will sacrifice themselves because they're low on victory points, and give me that little bit of
high
a speed
on protein.
Bump. High on protein, and tastes great, and they are less filling. But yeah, duelists do count as shooting, my opinion. So yeah, it's a great army to play, and it gives you, you know, for the painter and the collector who likes to play different stuff that not everyone is playing, it's a perfect opportunity to play and come up with an army that, you know, people don't regularly see all the time. So, congratulations, Games Workshop, for trying to phase out my favorite army. Well, at least they're not repackaging it in plastic and charging me three times more.
I guess
that matters.
So, yep, Dogs of War. They're fun. They're beautiful to paint.
Yes.
And they look good.
And, you know, like I said, they don't have... The rules aren't bad for them, so...
And they still have the fun fluff stuff.
They really do.
Those great things. So, we're going to stop kicking the dead horse. There's a Dogs of War armor review. And I think real quick...
Well, that was my take of the Dogs of War last summer. And it's grown a little bit since. It's one of my favorite armies to play, because it's not standard. And a lot of humans, a lot of elves, well, not a lot of elves, well, dark elves, dwarves, ogres. It's a hodgepodge army that I think has a nice theme to it. It's a my mortal army, so to speak. So, yeah, that was that. So I hope you enjoy. And if I get any buddy that doesn't like it, want me to redo it now, you think I could do better, just shoot me an email. And... we'll go ahead and we'll have a word from our sponsor. Then we'll start right after that, the Dan Abnett interview from Games Day 2009.
Cool City Games, Blue Water's most complete source for miniature wargaming and sports cards. Cool City Games offers a safe and friendly environment with free open gaming and up-to-date new releases, restocks, and hassle-free special orders. You can even put stuff in layaway. Cool City Games even offers box and case pricing on cards and collectible miniatures. Located in downtown Port Huron, that is in Michigan for all you out-of-towners, Jeff and Mike are available and ready to serve all your hobby needs. Stop by at 724 Huron Avenue or visit on the web at www.coolcitygames.com.
Alrighty, well, we are here at Games Day Toronto with Dan Abnett. We want to thank you for taking time out of your book signing to talk with us.
My pleasure, absolutely.
So, we're going to first get off with a... That's a bad, probably a bad wrong thing to say. We'll probably start off with a couple few questions. First and foremost, when did you start your writing?
When did I start? I started about 20 years ago, I guess, working for Marvel Comics in the UK. That was my first professional gigs, was writing there. And I've written, I still write comics for Marvel and DC and companies like that. I've done it for 20 years. And it was about, I guess, about 12 years ago now that the Black Library, newly founded Black Library, approached me. They wanted comic book writers to write their new Warhammer comic. And somebody had seen some stuff I'd done on Conan for Marvel. And once I started writing the comic strips, they said, do you want to write short stories? And I went, yeah, I'd love to, because I've got an opportunity to write non-comic work. And from that, they went, what about novels? And I went, yeah, okay, then. And that was it. So 36 novels later.
It's 36?
I think it is. I've lost count, but it's about 36, yeah.
What comics did you do?
I wrote many, many stuff, things for Marvel, including The Punisher and West Coast Avengers and Iron Man and that kind of thing. And for DC, had a 5-year run on the Legion of Superheroes and wrote a character called Resurrection Man that was a creation of mine. And with my comic co-writing partner, Andy Lanning, we are at the moment, in comic terms, exclusive to Marvel, writing their cosmic books. So we're doing Nova, Guardians of the Galaxy, War of Kings, all the superheroes in space stuff, basically, which is the stuff that I loved when I was a kid, the Jim Starlin stuff of Captain Marvel, the Warlock, and that kind of stuff. So, so yeah, loads of bits.
Heck of a career. So do you actually play any Games Workshop games?
I have played every single game at least once in order to understand the mechanics so that I can at least represent it reasonably well when I'm writing the fiction. If I don't have time to play on a regular basis, because I wouldn't get any writing done, because if I started playing, I'd start collecting an Imperial Guard army and that, you know, that would be it.
Yes, it would be.
Yes, it would be. You see, I should be tempted to do that. But I like to play everything, particularly if a new game comes out or a new thing comes out. And the guys at my local Games Workshop store in Maidstone, where I live, will set up a game for me, and they'll get some of their regulars in, and we'll play a game, and they'll teach me how it works, which can be enormous fun, because it teaches me as much about the players, the different interests. You know, not every Warhammer player is the same. You know, there's the guy who loves the rules, there's the guy who loves the models, there's the guy who loves the world and the mythos, there's the guy who loves the role-playing aspect. You know, there's all sorts of different things there, and it's great watching them around a table and what they're each getting out of it, and sort of that can teach you a lot about what you should put in a story as well.
Now, do you ever, when you go to do your thing about plotting out your chapter, your scene, do you ever sometimes play a game to see what happens?
I have taken moments from games when things have randomly happened and thought, that was a really cool thing, I'll try and duplicate that in a novel. That's a good idea, actually. I never thought of that. Playtest my ideas.
You heard it first.
Yeah, there you go. See what I mean? You talk to somebody, you get an idea. Yeah, no, that's a good idea. I do have an unhappy tendency, particularly when there's no one else around, of acting them out, acting the scenes out, putting on funny voices, and sometimes making the sound effects. But that's my own dark secret.
There's audiobooks coming up soon.
Yeah. Yeah, they won't need special effects. I'll just make all the noises myself.
On the same lines of talking about, have you ever come up with any ideas? What's your inspiration for writing your novels? I mean, it gets a very wide range of from Bell Cargo to Malleus Darkblade to the Space Marines.
It's inspiration, all sorts of different areas, and sometimes it's not exactly what you think it's going to be. I mean, obviously, my basic line of inspiration for most novels is whatever the Games Workshop thing that I'm dealing with. So if I'm writing, as I'm about to be, writing a novel about Space Wolves, because the next one is the Horus Heresy Attack on Prospero, I'm handling the Space Wolves side of things, whilst Graham McNeil handles the Thousand Suns. So, obviously, I go to Space Wolves as my starting point, obviously, because that makes sense. But I will then step sideways and I'll research Vikings and Norse and Danish. For instance, for Riders of the Dead, the Warhammer novel, I researched Polish hussars and then translated it as if it was a historical novel, and then translated it sideways into the Warhammer setting. Sometimes it's the most unlikely thing will come along. I'll see something, I'll read something in the newspaper and go, that's a good idea, and I'll find a way of sort of Warhammerizing it. You know, sort of, it's a sort of sidelong way of dealing with it. And sometimes it will be a specific action or event that I will then work into the. So it's all sorts of both sort of micro and macro levels of inspiration. Either a big idea for a book or a small idea that you can translate easily. And I read an awful lot of nonfiction and a lot of newspapers and magazines. And I'm always, wherever I go, I've got a notebook and I just write things down. And I realise that sooner or later, often in the most unlikely way, an idea is going to bubble to the surface, and something that I thought was going to turn up in, I don't know, Legion of Superheroes actually turns up in a Gorn book, or, you know, because that's the most useful way of using it.
How the heck did Malleus Darkblade bubble up? I mean, he's after reading those books, I was like, wow. I mean, he's such a ruthless character. Then in your style of writing, you make me feel bad for him for a while. Then he does something to remind me about how much really of a dickhead he is.
Absolutely. He's a good, interesting example. Obviously, Malleus started out as a comic book character because he was in the Warhammer comic originally. And I think I sort of went for him because he was easy. I didn't want to just write a comic strip that could be any old fantasy comic. I wanted something that was absolutely definitely Warhammer. I said Warhammer through and through, and I thought Dark Elves, the visual look, the fact that it's really an anti-hero, all these kind of things spoke to me of Warhammer in particular, which has got that kind of dark, cynical side to it. It's not like regular fantasy, is it? It's got this kind of macabre, sort of grotesque element to it. And he seemed like a great character, and I started writing it and thought, you know, let's just really relish writing a villain doing horrible, horrible things. And inevitably, when you sort of get a story like that, you then end up with a situation where if you have any drama, bad things have got to happen to him, and that's when you end up feeling sympathetic.
Yes.
And then I deliberately had to come along and do some exposition in a book, you know.
Yeah, if I ever win the lotto, can I make a movie about Malleus Darkblade?
Be my guest, yeah, absolutely.
Now, working with the Games Workshop IP, how hard is it as an author to say, now, do they give you, yes, you can write about this, or we'd like you to write about this, but don't talk about this, this, and this, or, you know, you can't say Malleus Darkblade killed Tyrion, you know, I mean.
Yeah, I mean, there are limits. Everything I write, I have to submit an outline. I mean, like any author, I submit an outline first and get it approved by that library, and that gets put through the studio to get to approve it. Certain things take more degrees of approval than others. So these days, for instance, Gaunt's Ghost, which is very much trundles along in the way that I needed to write, I have greater flexibility there. Very few things I could do in Gaunt's Ghost that would make the studio go, no, that's not 40k anymore. And they correct my mistakes. I'm like everybody, I make a mistake every now and then. I go, you know, you can't do that. Something like the Horus Heresy requires a huge amount of approval, and we have regular meetings, particularly with Alan Merritt, who is lordy lordy god king of everything. You know, he's the continuity master, and we basically have to submit our ideas and run them through him and get him to approve that things can happen that way, and that we are not. And the lovely thing about it is that because he guards the IP. Alan at first was very cautious. He didn't want us to break all the toys, obviously. But when we'd written the first couple of books, he loves Horus Rising, and he loves the early books, and he realised that we could be trusted. So for things like Legion, the Alpha Legion story, is a great case in point, and it's just happened again, actually, with our planning for the next few Horus books. But Alan actually gets sort of mischievously excited by it, and actually sort of goads us on to do more than we were actually going to do. You know, he actually comes up with more outrageous suggestions than the ones that we give him. With Legion was a great example, because the Alpha Legion is all about secrecy, and I wanted the book about the Alpha Legion to contain at least one great secret, to contain something about the Alpha Legion that the readers and the players and the fans didn't know. So thinking that would be a little bit of a hard sell, I worked out six or seven things that I thought would be great reveals, you know, some bigger secrets than others, but some great reveals. And I had a meeting with Alan, and basically my tactic was going to be, I'll give up on all of them until he gives me one. If you see what I mean, I'll sacrifice most of these ideas in order to get one of these past him, because he eventually, okay. So they were, but because I didn't realise he'd loved Horus Rising, so I said, right, I want to do this. And he went, yeah, fine. And I went, oh, I want to do this. And he goes, yeah, that's fine as well. And I got tick, 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 all down on the list. And then he gave me an even bigger, shocking one that I could put in if I wanted to. And I went, oh, that's great. So I came out with more than I was expecting. He'd be the first person to say, no, you can't possibly do that because it doesn't fit, or it's contradicted by something. But he's also there to say, let's see how far we can take this. Because, you know, if we write a book where we reveal something, and I think we're about to do this in the Horus Heresy, I have to say, after the Prospero books, we're about to reveal something that is so fundamentally fantastic, but makes perfect sense. So it will blow everybody's minds, but they won't come as a. It won't be wrong. It won't feel like we've added something that shouldn't be there. It'll be added something that clearly was there all the time, just nobody knew about it. So those kind of approvals. But every now and then they catch up. Titanicus, the book about Titans, funnily enough, clues in the title, that I wrote last year. I'd been planning to write for about 2 years, so I had it. It was one of these books that I'm carrying around in my head. And we've got two or three in there bubbling away. And I had it so clearly worked out what was going to happen and what the nature of the threat was and what the dynamic of the novel was. And finally I got to the top. It almost matured in my head, you know, like a fine wine, ready to be written. And just before I started writing it, I submitted my proposal. And it was actually Alan Courtney. He said, and I'd basically made one mistake. It was a simple mistake to make, but I'd misunderstood something in the IP. And I got one bit wrong, but it was such a crucial bit. I had to dismantle the whole plot because I could no longer do what I wanted to do. Not because I was trying to do something that they didn't want me to, but I was doing something that was simply wrong. You know, it was already established to be wrong. So I had to rebuild it. I'm pleased with the book. It was fun building it back up again, but it was a great example where they went, no, you've misunderstood. It couldn't possibly be like that. Not in a million years could that possibly happen. So, you know, every now and then you get caught out.
How long does it take you to write a book?
With the exception of Blood Pact, the latest Gaunt's Ghost, it usually takes me between 3 and 4 months. So I usually reckon to do about three a year, so I've got sort of fallow time to fit other things in. Bearing in mind that I'm writing comics all the time as well. So I actually get up in the morning, I write in my morning session, I write novels, so I write a minimum of 3,000 words a day. Sometimes more, but it's got to be a minimum of 3,000 before I break for lunch. Then I break for lunch, and then I write in the afternoon, I switch to comics, and I write a minimum of 5 pages of comic book. And it's usually more than that, but again, it's the minimum that I've done. So that's roughly how I run things together. Blood Pact, the new Gaunt's book, has taken me longer, and which is why it's been slightly delayed. I'm really pleased with the book. I'm very, very proud of it. I think the readers are going to really, really like it. But it was a new starting point for the series. It's the beginning of the fourth arc, so it's a jumping on point. And also, I've written 11 of them before. It's my longest series. And each book I do, and it doesn't just apply to Gaunt, but everything, whenever I write a book, the next book I write In my head, I'm going, how can this be better? What can I do to this that makes it better than the last one? Just raising the bar on myself and sort of trying to boost my own sort of... Because I'd hate to write a book where the readers went, oh, yeah, he's just coasting now. Well, this wasn't as good as the last one. So I always try and push myself further. What can I do with Gaunt that I haven't done before? What can I, you know, play around with? And with Blood Packs in particular, you've got 11 of them before, you've got to raise... I've kept raising the bar, and so the 12th book is like, this is a real challenge. You know, what can I find to do with this? So it has taken longer to do than I was expecting, but I think the end result's going to be good.
Now, do you also draw comics as well, or do you only just do the writing for it?
I only write them now. I started being interested in comics because I used to draw as a kid, and when I discovered comics, I realised it was a way of drawing and writing stories at the same time, which were my two favourite occupations. And I used to draw my own comics as a teenager, which is how I got into it. But there came a point where I realised I couldn't draw fast enough to tell the stories I wanted to tell. So I switched to the writing side of things and went from there. But yeah, sometimes I draw sort of thumbnails and sketches and layouts for artists to work from.
Now, I've been on your website and your homepage. It's very interesting how you click on stuff. Now, did you come up with the idea on that, or give me a little bit behind that?
The website's just a bit of fun, really. I have a friend of mine called Matthew Snyman, who works in film. Actually, he basically built it for me as a favour to have fun with it, because he's very sort of creative that way. And he basically took loads of photographs of me and then took loads of photographs of my work, and we played around with stuff, and then he devised all sorts of images, the comic book pages and stuff like that. And then I came in and gave him words to go in the balloons. But he sort of gave me all the visual stimulation, we could do this, we could stick your head on this and that kind of stuff. So it was Matt Snyman's inventive brain did most of that.
So what's your favourite book you've written so far?
Oh goodness, I have... That's very difficult, because it's to suggest that I've got a favourite suggests that I've got ones that I don't like. And I have never... I haven't yet written a book that I have gone, oh, I hate that, I never want to see it again. My favourite book is often the most recent one I've written, because it's the one that's most invested in, it's in my head. But I also... There are some that I have a certain fondness for. The Eisenhorn trilogy, for instance. The Gaunt's Ghost books, particularly Necropolis and Honor Guard, particularly the things about those that I remember incredibly fondly. I think Necropolis, because it was such an early book and it was the first one where I felt that I'd really got the hang of it, you know, I really felt confident with it. And I'm very fond of Riders of the Dead as well, which is the Warhammer book about the Lancers, which I like very much.
What was your favourite character that you've ever wrote about?
Goodness me, that's difficult too. Often the villains, Rawn in the Gaunt books, and some of the bad guys in the Eisenhorn and Ravenel books, like Zygmunt Molotov and Orfeo Kalzin. I just love writing the villains for some reason. But I don't know, also very fond of, I'm just enormously fond of people like Larkin and Gaunt himself, and characters like Harlan Nail in the Ravenel books. Would you know, regular heroes that you sort of, you know, you start writing another book in the series and you go, oh, it's them again. Isn't it sort of nice to see them, like old friends, you know, sort of, which is great fun to do.
Now, are there any new fantasy books on the horizon?
I'd love to do another Warhammer book. I haven't... At the moment, with Gaunt and the Horus books and the prospect of doing some more Inquisitor books, a third trilogy to finish the Eisenhorn-Ravenel trilogy of trilogies off, and that will be called... The working title at the moment is the Beckwin trilogy, and the idea is that it will be Eisenhorn versus Ravenel for the last three books, so that'll be quite fun. So it's goosebumps.
Here's one to my next question.
So my workload is pretty full. I've also got a three book deal with HarperCollins, the British publisher, to write my own science fiction for them. So I've got the first one of those, which funnily enough is a fantasy novel called Triumph, which comes out in October this year, and then there'll be a science fiction combat one next year. But I'd really love to do another Warhammer novel, and I'd really love to do a big... I'd love to do, as it were, the Warhammer equivalent of Titanicus. That is to say, a big novel about a whole city under attack, and the novel goes from the highest to the lowest, so the lords at the top and the peasants at the bottom, and you follow all of them, sort of like Arthur Haley writes Warhammer, you know, like a great big airport novel, and you're following all the different characters, all the different levels, following one big incident through to its end, and I'd love to do that with a, with, you know, sort of a, an empire city-state, you know.
Well, my next question was, well, will we ever see Inquisitor Eisenhorn again?
Well, as I've already mentioned that, yes, he will be coming back. When I wrote Eisenhorn, the Eisenhorn trilogy was always intended just to be a trilogy. It was a finite ending, because the game was current, and also the character was part of the game. So I figured I'd write the stories about him, and then I sort of leave him, and his ultimate fate should be decided by the players playing the game in their own individual ways. I thought it was the fairest way to do it, which is why I switched to Ravenel, and Ravenel was going to be an ongoing series. But having written three of those and realised that was such a neat trilogy, I realised that they had to be in three book lumps. So by the time I'd written the Ravenel trilogy, I thought, I'd like to write some more Inquisitor stories with these characters, but I think I need to move on to another character in the same way that I moved from Eisenhorn to Ravenel, which is why I picked Elizabeth Beckwin from the first books. And at that point, with the changes in Inquisitor as a game and that kind of stuff, I thought, actually, now the time has come where I could go back to Eisenhorn, and I'm no longer treading on anybody's toes, finding out what happened to him and sort of following his destiny. And everybody seems to want to see him back. So I thought to take Eisenhorn and Ravenel and put them back into a final trilogy together would be a great thing to do.
Now, together or pitted against each other?
Well, I think there's a very... very versus. I think there is going to be antagonism. I don't think it's going to be clear cut, and I think why they are working against each other will be part of the complexities of the novel, but I think it's going to be very interesting to have them in opposition. I was going to say like some Aliens versus Predator, but I don't want to suggest, you know, something bad.
Now, here's a good question about Ravenor. I've always wanted to know this, because Eisenhorn was my... I read it every year. In the second book, when you introduce Ravenor... Ravenor seemed to me to be kind of like a Wolverine character, this guy that could do everything, could really kick butt, and then he kind of turned into like a Professor Xavier kind of. That's who I imagined in my head. When you were writing and you wanted to prepare his character, did you automatically want to go in that direction with Ravenor?
I don't really know what direction I wanted to go with Ravenor. Ravenor as a character has been around since the very first Gaunt book, because he gets name checked in there. It was a name that I threw in. His book gets mentioned. And so I think part of me was thinking, when I wrote him into Eisenhorn, I was thinking, oh, it'd be fun if Eisenhorn's protege was the same name as the guy that Gaunt mentions. It's just that joining things up. I had no more plan or intention than that. I just thought, oh, I'll call him Ravenor, that'd be fun. Oh, that means he's got to be a psyker, and he's got to write books. And then I did something nasty to him, and I was left with the character that I got, and I thought, well, you know, he becomes the focus of what happens next. And it was sort of a really organic process. There was no strategy in mind. I just thought I'd go with it and see where he took me. And the really annoying thing is, as you mentioned this, not for the first time this weekend, he's an incredibly powerful psyker, confined to a wheelchair with a team of extremely able guys who... Honest to God, I was halfway through the second Ravenel book when I suddenly went, oh my God, it's Professor X. It looks like I did it, I thought, oh, I'll use that as a model. I really didn't. I saw the similarity, and I hope that it's sufficiently distant in terms of their actual characters and personalities.
Oh, yeah.
Just work in a different way. But I suddenly saw this parallel, and I thought, why didn't I notice that? That was so stupid.
You did write for comics, yeah.
Yeah, yes, and that's why people are going to go, yeah, you must have ripped them off, look.
Here's a good question. Why should people read your books?
Because...
They're awesome.
I don't... That's such a difficult question to answer. I write them because when I first started writing them, I was thinking, how do I write a book that I think other people are going to like? And I realised the only way of doing it was to write books that I would want to read. So that is... The only person I'm writing really to please is myself. If it entertains me, I figure it might entertain somebody else. And that's why that whole raising the bar thing and trying to push it up there. Obviously, as you write a book and you put it out there and people do seem to like it, it propels you, it galvanizes you. And I come to a convention like this and see how enthusiastic people are about it and how they get goosebumps. Yes. And that makes me go home going, I've got to write another one, because that's great if people are getting that. You know, people know more about these characters than I do. People are more invested. People, you know, when I kill off characters in Gaunt's Ghost, mentioning no names, no spoilers, but when I kill them off, people get. I've been threatened. I had one guy who was going to swing for me one because I killed this character off, and I said, but you know, the fact that they care that much is an enormous motivating factor. It's one of those things. Writing books is the way I'm doing it. It sort of builds its own momentum. Once you've written a couple and you're getting good feedback, you want to do more, and you want to do more. And I also really, really love writing. Some writers don't. Some writers find it a struggle. You know, they have the great ideas, but translating it into words is difficult. I, generally speaking, just enjoy the process, which is probably why I write so much. And to get then great responses from people propels me on to do other things. And sometimes people will say something. They'll come up to me at a convention and they'll mention a character, or they'll ask me a question about something that I've never even thought that anybody would be interested in. And I'll go home thinking, actually, maybe that's where I should go next, because clearly somebody thought about that. Somebody thinking about it in a way that I hadn't thought about, which is very often very surprising. They'll come up with the strangest questions, and they'll be really concerned about something, and I'll go, shouldn't you be worrying about, you know, for instance, the massive continuity mistakes I every now and then I make in the Gaunt's Ghost series? No.
I just go.
The thing is, every time I catch one of them, I have to repair it. And that's why we have two characters in the Gaunt's Ghost stories who died and then came back to life again. And I didn't realise I'd accidentally brought them back to life again, so I had to work out explanations for why they had survived, which I did, I think, quite cunningly and subtly. But having made a point of saying why they'd come back to life, they then became major characters, which is really strange, because they weren't before. But they were characters that sort of achieved prominence because I'd had to take the time to explain why they were still alive.
Where the heck is Milo?
Every now and then a character like Milo or Egan Sorek will leave the book, and the idea that we will come back to them at some point. There's the moment, well, Sorek was one. Milo, obviously, at some point, that storyline will be picked up in again. And the other one that everybody always asks about is McVenna, who is on Geryon as a sort of Warhammer 40k Robin Hood. So there are characters that they want to come back to, but and I will. But, sometimes you don't... Yeah, I mean, without being specific in terms of spoilers, there was a very nasty character in the middle sequences of the books as they stand at the moment. He did some really nasty things in one book, and I knew that everybody was going to expect him to get his comeuppance in the following book. You know, it was almost like a prerequisite that they would want to see this guy hung out to dry in the next book. So I didn't. I deliberately didn't because I thought.
Did you?
because I knew that would be the last thing people was expecting. I actually made it worse and then resolved it later on, and I think that keeps a reader on his toes. If I just do the what they assume is going to happen every time, it's going to get very very repetitive, I suppose.
I was surprised when he wasn't dead in the next book.
Yeah, right? Yes, absolutely. Not as surprised I was when I discovered that one of the characters in the Gaunt's Ghost book has changed sex since the character was first introduced. Minor character doesn't matter. Matters to me when I discovered. I went, what? Change sex? Okay. So, I don't know how I'm going to explain that one. Somebody suggested the warp.
That has gone excellent.
Yeah.
Okay, if people could read only one of your books / series,
right,
which one would you choose for them to read? Say that they didn't know you and they were like, "Oh, this guy is awesome."
So, which one would I recommend as a place
yes.
to start?
Yes, where is the best? Like,
that's difficult. I think if as a standalone starting place in terms of something I'm enormously proud of, and I know from the responses of people like yourselves that it's very highly thought of, it's the Eisenhorn trilogy. You know, it's in a lovely single volume edition. You can sit down, you can read it, and it's got everything going for it. And I think if you like that, you'll like anything else I do. The only thing I would qualify that with is that Eisenhorn is not terribly representative of 40k because it's away from the battlefield. So the other one I would recommend, I guess, is the Founding, is the first Gaunt collection, because that's much more accessible. It's much more direct. You just plow straight into that, and it's Imperial Guard action all the way. And I think that's an easier, if you're not familiar with the hobby and you're not familiar with my work, that's an easier way in. But Eisenhorn is the if you like that, you'll like anything.
What about a fantasy book?
Obviously, I've written fewer of those. I'm still incredibly proud of Riders of the Dead, so that was the one I... And I do like Fel Cargo, my Pirates book, but I think the Warhammer world in terms of the IP has changed slightly. It doesn't fit anymore, but I think it's a great fun book, but it doesn't quite fit into Warhammer as it exists today. It's sort of a non-representative of Warhammer.
Okay, so another question I have for you is... I absolutely love the book Warriors of Ulric, my favorite fantasy book of yours. Problem is that since it's one of some of your older works, you can't find it.
No.
Do you know any way that people can get some of your older works, like Riders of the Dead, Gilead?
Yes, Gilead. Yes,
and Warriors of Ulric.
John.
Yeah, he was gonna come today, and he was gonna send me with Warriors of Ulric, which is my favorite book, which I don't own, to have you sign it. Can you imagine that? I was like, yeah.
I don't know what they're planning. I suggested, actually, and I don't know whether they're going to do this, but I suggested they took the three or four, in fact, there's four Riders and Ulric and Gilead and Fel Cargo, and do them as the Dan Abnett Warhammer omnibus.
Oh,
put them all out in one book together, because I think there'll be enough people who want to see that. The reason I think they've hesitated that is that there might be other ways in this day and age when technology is getting to the point where you can print on demand in so many bookshops, where you can go in and say, I want a copy of that, and they give you one. That might overtake the need to produce an omnibus that stays in stock. But I don't know. I think there is some thought of re-releasing or republishing those in some form. I mean, the thing is, they could even do them as downloads, couldn't they? So you could put them on your Kindle or your whatever.
Because I would do that. Like, I mean, we said Warriors of Org is...
Yeah. Yeah, and it'd be nice to revisit some of those characters. I'd love to go back and write some of that again, you know, sort of go back to them. So we'll see.
So in closing, I think one last question so we can get you back to...
Yes,
I know. say if people wanted to try to write and wanted to maybe try to go down the way of writing for Warhammer or Black Library... Mm-hmm. What's a tip? What's something?
Two basic, no, probably more than two, but some very simple things that you should bear in mind. If you want to be a writer, you've got to write. I know that sounds incredibly trite thing to say, but you've really got to. There's no point saying, I want to be a writer, having never lifted a pen or written a word. So you need to be writing regularly. You need to be writing all sorts of stuff. You need to be trying stuff out. You need to be thinking about ideas. Even if you don't produce one particular thing, if you're writing every day, I always liken it to exercise. If you're an athlete training for any event, you would exercise and train regularly to build up your strength and your muscles for the big event. You wouldn't try and run a marathon if you couldn't jog down the road to the pet shop or whatever. So that's exactly the same with writing. You need to build up those writing muscles so that when you get to something like a novel or a short story, that you've got the muscles there to deal with it. The second thing is to read. Everything and anything, just input. Look at what other people do. I'm not suggesting you read in order to plagiarise. I'm not suggesting you read in order to rip people off or copy their style, but just look at what people are doing. If you're constantly feeding your mind with reading, non-fiction as well as fiction, then you're keeping, I think, your brain topped up with stuff. I think it's, in my own instance, I think it's a matter of it even being words, just words alone. If I haven't read anything for two or three days, I can't write. It's like words are the fuel. I need to pour the words in order for words to come out. So you need to write... All sorts of inspiration and ideas come out of reading, and you should get to the habit of keeping a notebook as well to collect them, because you will not remember them. You'll have a great idea on the bus and you'll go, oh, I'll remember that when I get home. No, you won't. So always write them down. And the third thing is to be patient with yourself and with the progress, because writing takes a while to get the hang of, and you will not necessarily be successful right from the word go. So have people read it. Bear in mind that you are writing. If you want to be a writer, then you'll need to have readers, because you can't be a writer on your own. You need people out there who are going to read your work. So you need to know if people like it, what they like about your writing, what they don't like about your writing, so you can remove that or change it or replace it. So show what you're writing to people. Get them to read it, and get them to be as honest as they possibly can in their feedback. And don't get incredibly upset if they don't like it. Instead of throwing a hissy fit and saying, well, you just don't understand my artistic... You know, forget that. Listen to what they say and actually use that as material. Consider it to be sort of something incredibly valuable, you know, that you could, sort of something you couldn't pay money for. You get in there, get the feedback they've got, and utilise that, and in terms of making your work better. Because, like I said, you need a reader. So if a reader says, the book was fine, but I didn't like what you did with the main character, then you need to rectify that to keep that reader and to add readers to it. So those are the really basic things. Read, write regularly, and get people to read. So the three R's, except some of those begin with W. But anyway, I'm sure you know what I mean. And then in terms of getting to the point where you've got a short story or a novel idea, and you've got a sample chapter and that kind of stuff, that's when you start submitting stuff to people and see if you get approval. And Black Library runs, I think it's every year, might be more than every year, they run a short story competition where you submit a short story on their chosen theme, and the winners get an opportunity then to, as you were, step up to the plate and do something professionally. And that is a great, great sort of... It's like America's Got Talent, you know, it's Warhammer's Got Talent. You go up there, it's your audition piece, you write a short story, if you're successful, the door is open for you, and that's a great way in.
Well, thank you very much for your time, and let's get back to what you're doing.
Thank you very much for talking to me. Thank you.
Well, there you go. That is the interview from Dan Abnett at Games Day 2009 in Toronto. And that was also a commercial for Cool City Games here in Port Huron, Michigan, done by my beautiful wife, Tanya. And I'd like to say thank you again, baby. And let's go on a minute and talk about what is on the foreseeable future for Sean Hammer. First, we're going to probably do the Blood Angels Codex Army Review. And I've been working on that for 2 days now, taking notes and everything, trying to find little sound bites and make it a little bit more interesting in the show. Soon after that, we'll follow the last of the Elf series. And that will be with Dark Elves, and we'll go over and talk about exactly how the Dark Elves, how they can benefit from what they have against High Elves. And as you'll see, Dark Elves can benefit pretty much from against anybody right now. And that'll start us into our new series, off and on, with the Dark Elves. So we'll finish up the Elves of the Old World. And then it'll also go into the Composition Army 3-tier. And what that is 3 tiers of the highest armies right now in competition play. And they are the Vampire Counts, the Dark Elves, and also Demons of Chaos. So we'll go over each of those in turn. I do not own a Warriors of Chaos book. I mean, not Warriors of Chaos, Demons of Chaos book. And when I do buy that, I'll go ahead and give an army review, and we'll give that away as a prize for listener feedback or possibly even iTunes review. And I also will probably be giving away the Skaven book pretty soon as well. Through this turbulent time, I'll also be finishing up the new guy section for Warhammer 40K. I know we have the Salt Phase to finish off, and probably vehicles, so we'll finish that off as well coming up. A lot of good stuff coming through. I'm going to be taking more pictures of my stuff and other people's stuff around my local hobby store, and posting those up on mybattalion.com. And you can find those pictures eventually when I do get them up. And you just look for Sean Hammer. Also, don't be afraid. Send me an iTunes review. Let me know how I'm doing. Or give me some feedback. Let me know how things are going. Two of our previous winners, Ray H. and AJ Knight, they both received their little prize packages I've sent them. Unfortunately, Ray's got a little damage in shipping. I thought he did a good job packing it, but email him pretty soon and let him know. Well, anyway, if you want to get a hold of me, you can contact me at Sean Hammer. The number 9, not the letter, at yahoo.com. You leave an iTunes review. I would appreciate that. And or you follow me on Twitter and Facebook, both under Sean Hammer. And if you enjoyed the little interview clips I gave in today's segment, you can check out the rest of me on miscastpodcast.com. And I guess I got to do a little legal disclaimer that Sean Hammer is no way affiliated with Games Workshop. And but I'd like to say that all the interviews from the two interviews on today's show are the property of Jason Justice with the Miscast Podcast. And I'd like to thank you all for joining me today. And I look forward to hearing from you soon. And, you know, remember, if you're not having fun, stop playing the game.